We are quickly approaching the end of 2024. And if you have not purchased an investment property yet this year, and it's been one of your goals, I need you to listen very closely. I know many of you live in areas where it's so expensive and investment properties seem impossible. I'm talking about some of the big cities. So LA, New York City, maybe even Seattle, Atlanta, places in Florida, and the list goes on. If you know that where you live is too expensive, I need you to lock in right now. Investing out of state changed my life as somebody living in California. I now invest in Ohio and I'm growing my portfolio. It's something that's possible. You just need the right information and execution. So if that's you, if you want to learn how to invest out of state, go to outofstatemoney.com and there is a free training that'll outline the steps for you and help you understand exactly what it takes. So go to outofstatemoney.com or simply go to the link in the description of this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 26. The purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming Black real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors. Shout out to our show sponsors, Mint Inc. Mint stands for the Minority Interdisciplinary Networking Team. Mint empowers young minority professionals with an interdisciplinary network for learning, collaboration, and the development of entrepreneurial ventures. They just released their new issue. Definitely make sure to check that out. You can also become a member of their network for free at mintinc-usa.com. You can also follow them on Instagram at mintinc_USA. We had another week of great Instagram lives. We had one on Friday with Andre C. Hatchett talking about the mobile notary business, which is still in demand in the midst of everything happening with the coronavirus. And I've had a lot of people asking me about different side hustles, different streams of income they can get started on. And so we had one about the mobile notary business. It was great. If you're interested in the course, definitely check out the link in the show notes or in the link in our link tree. We also have one on Saturday with Far Roots Investments, which is an investment group that I'm a part of here in LA. So we just talked about the market, different things that are happening right now, and then got into Q&A for those who are in attendance. And on Sunday, we have one with the personal finance mentor, our friend Trey Thompson. He just started an Instagram page about personal finance. So we had a conversation about personal finance, credit, and how those things may impact your real estate investment journey. And I'd like to dedicate this show, this episode, to my grandmother, Susan Azmar, who unfortunately passed away a couple of days ago at the age of 97. It's definitely a hard time for me, hard time for my family. I actually lost my other grandmother a couple months ago. So definitely keep my family in your thoughts and prayers. We'll greatly appreciate it. Also, don't forget to leave us a rating and comments. It helps us reach more people. It helps us to move up in the rankings as well. We just cracked the top 200 in investing podcasts on Apple Podcasts last week, which is pretty cool. We're also on Twitter. Follow us at Bread Podcast, at BRED Podcast. We also are accepting show sponsors. So if you're interested in sponsoring a show, send me a DM or email. We can talk further. We also have a lot of resources in the show notes and in the link tree from our partners about different real estate investing strategies, different side hustles, credit, so on and so forth. Just different things to help you in various areas. So highly encourage you to check out some of those. Also sign up for our email list. It can be found, the link can be found in the show notes. By signing up for our email list, you'll get discounts, additional content, resources, our newsletter, and so much more. Lastly, feel free to buy our merch. Buy one of our shirts. It comes with a free home buyer's dictionary. Without further ado, let's get into it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. I'm very excited for this episode today. Here with me, I have Darius and Courtney from Petway Estates out of Louisville, Kentucky. Thank you both so much for hopping on today.
No problem, glad to be here.
For sure. So first question we usually ask, what were each of your childhoods like and what did you see or what didn't you see that shaped your view of building wealth?
Okay, I'll go first. My childhood, regular, you know, middle class family. My mom was a teacher. My dad was in the Air Force. So, you know, we weren't poor, but we weren't rich. You know, we were living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, as far as I know. You know, didn't have, I had entrepreneurs in my extended family, but I was too young. I didn't really pay attention. So in my immediate family, I wasn't really exposed to entrepreneurship in general on a larger scale until I was probably in my teens. My first job was at Smoothie King. A couple from my church hired me at the time. They were only like 26, 30-ish, gave me my first job. So they kind of planted the seed in me of entrepreneurship, seeing a young Black couple have my granddaddy had his own car shop, but I would say that kind of planted the seed in me. Yeah. I wanted to go do something and own something of my own.
I think that's just always been me. just wanting to be able to give stuff to my children. I think it definitely solidified actually my undergrad. I graduated along with another young man who didn't look like me. We both were student government presidents of our universities. But when I graduated, I was desperately looking for something as to where when he graduated, his father was one of the founding members of Chick-fil-A. So,
He was set.
He got to go right into Chick-fil-A admin. That's where he was. So I think that solidified. And also sitting on the board of trustees at Auburn University as an ex officio member, just rubbing shoulders with millionaires and billionaires and just seeing, you know, how they approached life and how they tackled different situations and asking questions. I think that solidified what I feel like I was kind of sort of born with, like this, I want my own. And I also want to be able to give to my children, you know, things that I have. I want to be able to have things that I can pass down. So, yeah.
For sure. For sure. And it's kind of off topic, but how did you two meet?
she was stalking.
I was not. All the time. I know I was.
Tried to break up with
no,
her.
No, I didn't. He actually didn't. Like, it was so random. He's
thirsty.
No. He actually met the for, I guess, rival teams, I guess you would call it. Rival teams. I was on the girls' team, obviously. So we knew of each other. We saw each other, but we didn't ever... Did we even have a conversation?
No.
just that black
girl.
Ah, nobody asked you.
She went to the other private school. I went to the black-owned private school.
Oh, whatever. Anyway, we knew of each other, but we didn't have a real conversation until we met in college. He was actually... at that time, he was running for SGA president. And so I was actually going to vote for someone else. And his sister came his sister came around and was basically like, you know, vote for my brother. And then I looked up and I was like, oh, that's, you know, I recognized him from high school. But we still hadn't talked. And I think one time in the computer lab, there wasn't that many computers available. So I went to a computer, got up and left. And I came back to him and I was like, you stole my flash drive.
She actually didn't say that.
I did say that. I did. I said, you. Oh, no, I asked you, did you have it?
Yes, thank you.
Did you have it? Basically, I thought you stole it.
Yeah.
Because I came back and then we lost. Anyway, I think that was like our first interaction.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. How did it go from
there? She just used that as a bridge. No, I didn't. She used that as a bridge into my soul.
I didn't. Because but it just... I guess over time, we just kept running into each other, and then we had some mutual friends as well, and we would hang out in groups. Eventually, he would ask me to play tennis and stuff, and eventually asked me out, and then here we are with a kid.
And another one
on the way.
Oh, wow. When is when do you do?
August 19th. We haven't officially announced it yet, but I guess this is the right
time. Oops. My bad.
You're good.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you two get together. Where did real estate come in? How did you two decide that real estate, or maybe one of you, where did the decision come in that real estate was going to be one of the means you use to build wealth?
Yeah. When I first moved here to Louisville, basically when I moved here, I lost all my connections. I spent a lot of time in Montgomery, Alabama, just rubbing shoulders, smiling when I didn't want to, in order, you know, to build bridges and to get potential jobs and things like that. So when I moved here, all of that was non-existent. And so I was just grinding when I got here. I remember I was working as a dishwasher. I was working for UPS. I was the general manager for a few restaurants, just trying to figure stuff out. And I was walking around my neighborhood. Shout out to Shelby Park.
Love Shelby Park.
We love Shelby Park. But walking around my neighborhood, and I saw like this house directly next to our apartment unit, and it was pretty dilapidated. And I thought to myself, how could I own that? Because it seemed like a great opportunity. And so from there, I started to pray. And then a few months later, I brought it to Courtney, my wife, my queen.
I didn't want no parts.
And she didn't want any parts. And so after a little while, she jumped on board, and that's all she wrote.
Wow. And what's funny, the house that he looked at, which kind of sparked his, you know, idea to get into real estate, someone actually just tried to sell us that house the other day. Of course, you know, we made our offer.
They wanted $90,000, and they just wouldn't get it.
No. But basically, that's kind of how it got started. When he brought it up to me, I definitely did not want to do it. At the time, I worked for U of L, a University of Louisville hospital, and I had a coworker who was a landlord. She owned, I think, like two properties. And all she had for me were horror stories every single day of something bad happening. And so obviously that was my introduction. Like, I am never going to do this, not working for her. You know, I don't want any parts. So I just realized that, you know, just because it doesn't work for her doesn't mean it won't work for me. And so we took our time to get educated, attended a few courses, you know, attended a few local trainings, got connected with our local RIA group. And that was what, almost 3 years ago. And so here we are now.
Yeah.
So what happened with that first property you identified? Once you agreed that, you know, all right, we could do this.
You're talking about the one that we said that came full circle and they tried to sell it to us?
Oh, so talking about the first property that we had under contract.
Yeah. Was it the one you saw by the apartment building? Was it that one?
They wanted to sell it to us, but okay. We made an offer and they didn't take it.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. Too high for the area and for what the property needed. Yeah. So we didn't end up getting that one. Yet. We'll see if they come back to their senses.
We got smarter.
Yeah.
Years, so.
Our first year, we'd have been like, yeah. It would have been in the red.
Definitely.
But we know better now.
Yeah.
Definitely. So let's talk about the first property you had under contract.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell it. I love telling this because it was a nightmare. So we got this property. And what's crazy is, even though it was a nightmare, we still ended up making money. It wasn't nearly as much money as we wanted to make, but we didn't have to bring money to the table, or we didn't lose money, which was good. Basically, it was a property. Our realtor brought it to our attention. We made an offer, got it under contract. We bought it for a little over 101. At the time, we thought we would be able to sell it for 240. Mistake number one. Pretty much had a horrible contractor that went ghost on us. Mistake number two, what happens when you don't vet your contractors. And then pretty much it was just a nightmare. We had it, I think the repairs were going to cost about 70. And then we were brand new, right? We knew nothing about real estate. Neither of us had a real estate background. So we're just kind of relying on what our contractor is telling us because we think they're the experts. This guy didn't pull permits. This guy just didn't do a lot of stuff. So we're finding stuff on the back end. And it was just a nightmare. So a project that should have only taken like 4 to 5 months took about almost 8 from close to close. So from the time we bought it to the time we sold it took 8 months. Shouldn't have taken nearly, nearly that long. Did we not make as much because we didn't sell as much as we wanted to? I can't remember the price, but it was definitely not too, it was not 240. No. It took longer, so we spent more in carrying costs because you got utilities, you got property taxes are accumulating, you got, what else? Yeah, just all of your carrying costs.
Yeah.
So we made a little over $8,000 on that project. Again, we didn't have to put in any work in, you know, we weren't there at the property every day and we didn't lose any money. So it's still good, but we were hoping to make at least, I think like 30 to 35. And yeah, so that's pretty much how it went. It was a nightmare. funding. We were able to secure a private lender. We did a joint venture. So they gave us 100%. They gave us the money for the purchase, the rehab, all the costs. And then we just split the difference. So we really made about 16 and then we split it between us and the lender.
Got it.
Nightmare, but because at least we bought low enough, we made some money even after the mistake. So right. We went on the buy, people.
Definitely. And then did you two continue flipping or did you get into other strategies as well?
We definitely continue flipping, but our name began to circulate, so deals begin to fall in our laps more so that we didn't necessarily have the time to do ourselves, so we started wholesaling as well.
Wow.
And so we got some really, really good wholesale deals. In fact, yeah.
The first year we did 15 deals.
Wow.
12 of those were rehabs. 3 of those were wholesales. We don't actually wholesale a lot. We only wholesale where we don't want to flip it. Yeah. Or if we don't want to keep it ourselves. Or, you know, the margin ain't big enough to where it's worth our time.
Right.
So we'll wholesale. Our primary is now wholesaling. Our primary is, you know, flipping. And then the goal is to continue to stack that capital to buy and holds. So out of the 15 deals, 3 were wholesales. Out of the 12, 2 of those were rentals. The other 10 were flips. That was the first year. Crazy.
Wow.
Would you tell someone new to do that? No. don't do it. We did it, but in hindsight, even out of those, you know, 10 flips, probably half of them we shouldn't have touched. Because we were just excited. We were just going so fast and we were just buying anything with a roof on it. And in hindsight, we're like, oh, we shouldn't have touched that. That wasn't worth our time. And so over time, we've gotten smarter and it has to be worth it for us to even make an, you know, just, it has to be worth it for our time. So.
For sure. I'm just kind of blown away. That's a lot. That's many deals to do in the first year. But I'm sure you learned so much in that period of time just by all the action you took. What would you say are some of the things you learned that helped to just refine your process going forward during that first year?
Understanding the chronology of a flip.
So out of way.
So from demolition to final finishes, understanding the details step by step. That is absolutely critical for your investors who flip. Now, if you're a construction worker or you have your own construction company, which we actually have now, and are in the middle of getting things vamped up there even further. But on the investor side, it is critical to understand the details, because if you understand the details, you're much less likely to mess up. Mm-hmm. And so I would say I would start with the chronology of a flip, again, from demolition,
you know, your costs,
to the final finishes, to knowing your costs, knowing them exactly, because that's going to help you keep all of your costs down. And then three, learning how to deal with contractors.
That's a big one.
So that's the trinity of what I would consider flipping.
Yeah. I think that's just
one, the details. I'm just going to state it for you. One, the details, understanding your chronology in regards to your flip. Two, finances, understand every penny in regards to costs. Mm-hmm. And then three, how to deal with contractors. If you can understand that trinity, you're going to be successful.
And I completely agree, because honestly, the first year, and this is some contractors, this is not all, these are some great contractors out here, but sometimes contractors are so thirsty for work, they will give you a bid. Let's say a job could clearly need nine, and we know this now, we didn't know it then. Let's say a job could clearly need $90,000 to $100,000 worth of work, which is for a gut, for a complete rehab, when you're replacing everything, you could easily spend $90,000 to $100,000. But when a contractor is coming in telling you, oh, I can do it for $60,000, $65,000, you know, then it wasn't a red flag for us. But what would happen is these contractors would just give these low bids to get the work, and they'll try to play you and try to charge you and upcharge you along the way. Oh, I didn't realize this was going to cost this much. No, you did. You just wanted the job and thought you can make money on the back end. And the third part, he said, knowing how to deal with contractors, is which is why you have to have your documentation, and you have to have detailed contracts, because fortunately, contractors weren't able to do that to us, because we had everything in writing. We don't care that you said that you thought it was going to cost 70 and it didn't. You signed this contract that said you will do this project from A to Z for 70, and I'm not going to pay you. Now, if I'm asking you to do something that was not in our scope, that's one thing. But when we already said more, no. So either you're going to take the loss, not us. So that's just something we also learned in the beginning too.
Very true.
I know that was probably a lot.
No, that was good. That was good. Speaking of contracts, what are some key things that you feel like you may have been missing in the beginning that you started to, as you learn more, you started to add on just to protect yourselves with contractors?
I would say in contracts, we were actually really good. I would say further, because with our contracts were the reason why our contractors were actually just ghost on us.
Because they knew they wouldn't win.
Because they knew that whatever they said, not only did we document, but we have documentation that is very aggressive in regards to our defense. And holding them accountable. So I remember one time there was this property that needed demolition, and there was like this auto shop in the back of it. And we allowed all of our contractors to walk through the homes and everything. And he saw this ahead of time, but he thought he was going to back and get over on us. But of course we showed him where, hey, not only did you sign this, but you walked through this property multiple times and you saw this. So he ended up doing about $10,000 worth of demo work, and we only paid him like $5,000. But he had to come up with that other part. Initially I felt bad, but I'd rather him than me.
Yeah.
Right? And he ended up ghosting on the project, but he was out $5,000, not me.
He was a clear example of someone who wanted to get, and again, we also take responsibility for, you know, not vetting. And so we vet even, well, now we don't even deal with general contractors. Before, we were hiring general contractors. Now we manage our own, and we have our own team of subs.
Got it.
Like, our last few flips have been definitely a lot better than when we had a general contractor. You would think having a general contractor would relieve you from the stress, and it actually added more because they got projects outside of yours and they're using money from one property to do another, and it's just a lot. But the reason why we were able to say, hey, we're not paying, this is what we agreed to pay you for, it's not our fault that you underbid. So he ended up doing it, but obviously he said, I can't continue to do this because I'll lose money, which was your fault because you should have assessed and given us a correct bid the first time.
Yeah,
definitely.
I thought it was really cool, though, the way our contracts allow us to twist his arm to get that demo done, because we wouldn't have got that much demo done for $5,000.
Yeah, you wouldn't. Right. Because what happened was, because it was two buildings, he pretty much had to tear down the back building. So dumpsters, an average 40-yard dumpster is easily $550 to $600. And I think he used eight to 10 dumpsters just to, demolish the property, throw everything away. So, I felt bad, but at the same time, it's like, look, business is business. It's not personal. And, people kind of joke on us because our scope of works are easily 10 to 12 pages. Yeah. But this is why, because details matter, because if you are vague in what you expect, they will use that gray to get over on you. Yeah. But when you're detailed and you can show them on page 3, line this, you signed this, you initialed it, you agreed to it, they can't argue with that.
Definitely. That's great. So as far as being your own general contractor, having your own subcontractors, what would you say are some of the advantages of that? Because it's funny, I was talking to someone recently who decided to do the same thing. It seems like you have a lot more control of what happens from start to finish. But what would you say are some of the other advantages of that? And how can someone work towards becoming the GC for their own projects?
So we're not GCs yet because, I can't speak for every state, but you have to be licensed here. So we call ourselves he says I'm a nerd, but I'm just trying to be technical because people are listening, so I don't want to give wrong information. We call GC loosely, but we're technically not GCs in the process of getting our license, but we're project managers, in essence the same thing.
Yeah.
But I just... don't want people to get confused. Anyway, some of the advantages is obviously time. You mentioned that cost. Whereas before, when we were hiring another general contractor, in addition to paying labor and material for their team, you're paying a GC fee. You're paying them just to oversee your project. So we eliminated that by doing it ourselves. We know who's going in and out of our property. So, I can control how many people are there. And then cost is the biggest factor. I know my material costs now, like the back of my hand. And it's just a lot cheaper. Like, we wouldn't be able to do some of the flips that we've done if we had to pay a GC fee too on top of that. Those are definitely advantages.
For sure. For sure.
She said it all.
What was I gonna say? Oh, you mentioned previously private money. Do you use hard money lenders, or do you raise money from individuals? How do you go about that to fund projects?
Both and.
Okay.
Of course, our main goal is to not touch hard money because it is so volatile. Mm-hmm. It can be so volatile. It's so much red tape, and they are merciless. So our initial goal is to raise, and we always have some degree of private money. So HMLs are really a last resort, but we use both and we leverage
all
opportunities.
Our first project, like we mentioned, that was private money because we did a JV. But for the most part, that first year, we used a combination of harmony and renovations. And then we would partner with the private money lender to fill in the gap. Sometimes people call it gap funders to cover, the down payment and the carrying costs. All other costs associated with flipping that people don't take into consideration. We used a private lender for that. Now, last year, I will say, was a big deal for us because we bought 5 flips and we only used hard money for one of them. All the other 4 were funded completely by private money. And those have been repeat people. Like, we've gotten to the point where we have repeat lenders who will constantly fund deals with us. So
yeah,
private money all day if we can use it. Yeah. And I understand sometimes private lenders, their funds will be tied up either in our projects or other investors they might be working with. And so we'll have to use hard money. But we have been fortunate to not use any of our own money when buying projects. So that's also a good thing too.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, I think that's a great skill to be able to raise private money. Would you say, what would you say enables you to be able to raise that money and, you know, sell people on this opportunity to make a return?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I would say, one, your footwork. I call your footwork what some people would consider homework. Mm-hmm. Someone is willing to grow their money with you when they see that you've paid attention to detail and you aren't mm-hmm. just an overly optimistic or overly zealous person trying. Mm-hmm. It's very important to have those details and to really answer the questions before they're asked. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of investors aren't going to even ask the questions. They're just going to say, hey, this person hasn't even considered this. Let me put my, mm-hmm. you know, $100,000 or $200,000 elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So it comes with the footwork. And then after you've done the footwork, it also comes with time. Mm-hmm. We've been in it, you know, not a long time, but we've been in it long enough as to where, again, we have repeat customers, repeat clients. So they've, you know, made good money with this. So why wouldn't they continue in that same vein? Right. So yeah, do your homework and also allow time to build your reputation. Mm-hmm. I think those two are, that's a dynamic duo mm-hmm. because people will tell people, investors will ask, hey, give me a reference list. So mm-hmm. you can now say, point them to this person that funded, you know, your last 2 projects, and they'll say, hey, I made this with them and they paid me this percentage out, and they've been consistent, they've been diligent. And just, yeah, it's as simple as that.
Out of all of our private lenders, we've only met 2 in person. Oh, one wow. is in Australia. I don't even know what she looked like. One is in Australia. We have another one in California. And so we've had even people refer us, like we'll tell them like, hey, we got this project coming up, you know, this is what we're offering, these are the details. And they'll say, you know, I'm out of money right now, but I got another friend who got a large, you know, 401k or retirement, they might be interested, let me put you guys together. And I think, again, it's about being detailed and really just presenting the facts. So a lot of people ask for our first flip that we got the 170. What person in their right mind is going to give $170,000 to an investor who has not in their life? Like, I know I wouldn't. I'm not even going to lie. Yeah. I'm not going to give $170,000 and you haven't flipped nothing. And so for us to even have been able to secure that kind of money, you know, says something about our presentation. You know, mm-hmm. we call it a private lender packet. And in our packet, we include everything about the property, like as much detail as we can, so they can make an informed decision on their end too. And I also think that helps as well, because they're like, oh, these people know what they're talking about. Even though at the time we had no idea what we were talking about, the fact that we were able to at least present information to help them make an informed decision, and the property that we're actually about to close on in a few weeks is with that same lender who gave us money for the first flip.
Wow.
So it's just good repeat business. And if you do good work on top of that, you'll always find money. If you have a deal, you'll find the lender. And if you're able to follow through, they'll become repeat lenders with you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And do you meet these people like on social media?
Would you yeah. say? Mm-hmm. Some yeah. of them have literally reached out. And some of them, of course, not everybody has 170. We had someone DM us the other day and say, hey, I got 10,000. you know, I want to help. And so, you know, they'll sign up. We make them read our packet, you know, so they. And they're interested, raise their hand per se, and we'll work with them on the deal.
That's very cool. That's very cool. It's crazy. We're in such a different age right now where so much business, so much money is being exchanged off of social media interactions, so many connections being made. So, I mean, I love it. I love it. You know, it's outside of the box, but I think it's the new normal. You know, that's kind of how people are meeting friends, how people are meeting business partners. And, you know, people from, I guess, the previous generation, it sounds crazy to them, you know, almost kind of like online dating. But it's like,
it's like my dad, and it's on my dad and my mom, they were like, wait, so this person who you've never met, who don't know you, is about to give you $170,000 to flip a property, and you've never done real estate a day in your life. And I said, yep, that sounds about right. It sounds crazy, but hey, you gotta leverage the platform you have to accomplish your goals.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what does the future look like? I know y'all are heavy in flipping now. Are you into buying and holding eventually? Like, what are some? And also, I know you mentioned the construction company too. So I'd love to hear more about the future and about that venture too.
In regards to the construction company first. In regards to that, we are able now, because we've been doing it so long, we're able to give our customers quality renovations at a great cost. Mm-hmm. Again, we're not paying GCs anymore. Mm-hmm. We have a tighter grip with different companies who supply, you know, different items, whether it be cabinets, fixtures or whatever. So our construction company helps us serve the retail client in a much better fashion. Again, you get quality at a great cost. Mm-hmm. And in regards to the investor side of things, we had a duplex and a fourplex. We still have the fourplex, but we're looking to expand. We're always looking to expand our rental portfolio. Mm-hmm. As opportunities come. So, and I consider rentals kind of the gold mine of real estate. Mm-hmm. The more rentals you get, the better, simply. Yeah. Because flipping is just one check. Mm-hmm. Rentals, you got a check for the rest of your life. So, yeah.
And then we're definitely picky about our properties, period, now, whether it's a flip. For example, like our rule of thumb personally, you know, if we can't make 30 minimum, like net 30 after all costs, we're not going to touch it. And that's minimum. So if I have 30 to 50% of the renovation. So if it's a $100,000 renovation, I'm looking to make at least 40 or 50, not 30, because, you know, I can wholesale a few deals and make 30 and not touch a flip. But that's just our rule of thumb. I know every investor is different. I know investors who will flip for 15. I would never do that, but that's just them. And so we're even more picky with our rentals because, you know, we're not trying to have tight cash flow margins, like and we still kind of vary a little bit on this. I know some investors, after all costs, they're okay with like $100 to $200 profit margin. I just feel like that's really risky, because if something goes out, you know, that's a year or maybe more of your income. So the reason why we flip so much is because we want to get to the point where we're buying properties free and clear, or putting a significant down payment on a property where your margins are not 200, there may be like 400 to 500 afterwards. So, you know, we're just really patient. You know, rentals, in my opinion, are harder to come by than flips.
Got it. That makes sense. So when deals, would you say you have a pretty consistent deal pipeline? Like, are you guys getting a lot of deal opportunities these days?
We're on a lot of host. We get a lot of leads, if that's what you're asking. Whether it's word of mouth, whether it's we're on a lot of host lists. And then, of course, we have a realtor who will shoot us some deals if she sees one on the MLS. So every day we got properties in our email. And I'll probably say out of every 10 properties or leads we get, one might be worth actually looking at. Because, right. Again, it's just a lot of people who have different criteria than us. And then some people just don't know what they're doing, honestly. Not to sound like...
Wholesalers included.
Yeah. Wholesalers, you know, rehab costs, because like, if you don't know your rehab, regardless if you wholesale, flip, buy, hold, it can just mess your numbers.
A house can be missing the entire foundation. They'll put all it needs is carpet.
Like, no. You need to jack up the floors. You need new subflooring. You need a lot of stuff. And we're laughing about it because we've been, you know, our first wholesale deal. Well, our first attempt, because obviously we couldn't find a buyer because it was crap. Our first wholesale deal, you know, people tried to tell us, like, look, you need to get out of this because this is not, no one's going to buy this. And so we've been there. So yeah, just know your rehab costs, people.
Definitely. So when a deal comes, or when leads come across your table, are you essentially evaluating if you could wholesale it, if you could flip it, potentially buy and hold? Is that typically like the process, the thought process you go through?
We're always looking. Can we flip it? Okay. No, we can't flip. Can we hold it? No. Profit margins are too low. Can we, you know, maybe Airbnb it? Nah, not right now because, you know, Corona. So that want to take that risk. Can we subject to it? No, this person don't have a mortgage. That's out. Can we, you know, do lease options? So we're looking at probably 5 to 7 rarely a property won't at least meet one of those. Like, there's one we have under contract right now, couldn't flip it because we wouldn't make any money, we couldn't subject to it because she owns it free and clear, can't lease option it, at least not right now, because it needs work, it's a full rehab, so it's not even moving ready. So we said, okay, we can't do any of that, but we can't wholesale it, you know, even if it's only 3 to 5,000, you know, that's still money to be made off a lead. So that's just how we process our deals.
Definitely. How's the Louisville market these days?
It's pretty steady right now. I would say, like, we have a property under contract. I just think it's based on your price points. Mm-hmm. We learned early on not to leave the higher priced home for this region alone. Mm-hmm. Selling houses for like 250 to 300, 315,
they will sit.
Like, they're gonna sit forever. Mm-hmm. So we try to hover around 150. We'll go up to 180, maybe even 2. Mm-hmm. But we try to stay in the lower range because that ensures that our pool of buyers, especially FHA buyers, mm-hmm. A lot more of them can afford a $150,000 loan versus a $250,000 loan. In addition to that, the people that can afford the $250 home are naggingly nitpicky.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, it is what it is, but we know our niche now. We stick with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, typically, like you said, that first year we were buying home, I think our most expensive home we sold for our market, you know, for other Cali, you're like, oh, that's nothing where I am. $300,000 home, like, that's that. Can y'all even find a $300,000 home where y'all at?
That's a good question. Probably few and far between.
Yeah. So, like,
that's probably gonna go way out to get that.
Yeah, that's like the higher end in our market. So we stayed away from those because, like you said, they tend to sit. And so we know now we want to stick to those homes between 150, 180. We know majority of the time we're going to get a first-time home buyer who's on usually FHA or sometimes conventional, but most of the time they're on FHA. They want closing help. They want the works. You know, you definitely, not saying we don't anyway, but you definitely want to make sure your home is solid because any little thing will scare them because they are first-time home buyers. So we know and we're familiar with that now. So we know our target audience when we're looking for deals.
Definitely, definitely. And so y'all are clearly doing a lot. There's a lot going on, a lot of work happening. How do you balance it all? Are you still both, in your 9-to-5s? And I know, there's a growing family now. Like how does all of this work for you?
Really, I would say our entire family is centered around the Christian. So there is no such thing as prioritizing business, so to speak. Now, although we do business, we understand that we have our whys. We do that to, better our community, glorify God, and really provide. So it starts with, again, a Christian faith from, the nucleus of our family is between us and God, right? It's between, it's a triangle, right? So you have me, Courtney, and you have God who's keeping us together by his grace and mercy, right?
Amen.
And then as our family is expanding, we prioritize each other. And then because we love each other, we love our children. And I understand that I'm called to provide. We are called to provide for our family. And so that's where real estate, that's where my job comes in. And that's all it is. It's simply a means to provide. And like I said in the beginning, be able to pass down things to my son. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. So I'm just trying to do my part. And I really glorify God in every aspect of our lives. So, yeah.
What's funny about, because you asked how do we balance all of it? And he does still work his job. I actually worked. Did I work the first full year? I worked the first full year and then I quit. And please, anybody listening, I'm not telling you to go quit your job. Keep your job. We did what worked for us.
Yeah.
And by that time, I think we had done one or two flips. We had picked up our first rental. And we pretty much, we went back to the basics pretty much. So before people get into investing, and I want to make sure I say this, you got to have good money management. You got to have the basics. You got to have personal finance down pat, because if you're struggling just managing the money from your, 9-to-5, can't pay bills, don't know what's coming in, don't know what's going out, how in the world are you going to manage a real estate business when you're dealing with other people's money too? You're talking about managing thousands. Like, if you don't have the basics, you can't do that. You're not ready to do that. And we had already kind of mastered personal finance, budgeting, living below our means. And so it was a no-brainer saying, okay, I'm going to quit my job because this will free up my time. It's not saying it's impossible to invest in real estate and work, but it is a little more difficult. And so by one of us quitting the job and being able to kind of do more in the business, not only allowed us to continue to scale and grow, but of course it provided obviously an additional source of income, and eventually he will quit his job. So yeah, that's how we balance it. One kind of spearheads it a little bit, and we still have our roles. Like, I'm obviously the kind of the number cruncher and the admin person. He's the field person. He's the one actually dealing with the contractors and doing stuff like out and more of like behind the scene kind of, funding and all of that stuff. So that's kind of how we make it work.
Definitely. And you mentioned one tip. What are some other tips you would give to someone who wants to get into real estate, whether it's flipping, wholesaling, buying, hold? What are a couple other things that they should definitely make sure they do, or maybe make sure they learn?
Get educated. Now, I'm not saying have analysis paralysis, because sometimes people consume knowledge for days and don't ever do nothing with it. That was me. And I can say that because that was me.
Probably quick.
He's definitely a risk taker. I am not. I'm the planner. Like, I want to know what this is going to look like. And then sometimes it don't work that way, but definitely educate yourself, but don't let not feeling you don't know enough stop you. Save, because stuff will go of savings. Get your credit up. We have been blessed to be able to find private lenders. I know that's not everybody's situation. You might borrow from if you don't have your credit up.
Um, Yeah. I would say we have a free break in our Peltway toolbox from start to finish on how to do real estate the right way. Mm-hmm. And again, it's free. Just make sure, I would just harp on what you said. Just get educated as much as possible. And you'll never be educated enough not to make mistakes and not to fail. Mm-hmm. When you do fail, cry, get up.
Mm-hmm. I will say, although we obviously still make mistakes, we avoided probably making even more mistakes because we took the time to learn from people who were where we wanted to be. And just learn what to do and what not to do. Again, just because you know or have a foundation don't mean you'll be perfect. You're still gonna mess up, but you can mitigate risk and decrease the amount of mistakes you make when you educate yourself. But that would be my biggest thing. And then get in there, because still experience is the best teacher. You can take every webinar, course, read every book, but nothing's gonna teach you like actually getting your hands dirty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. This has been an incredible interview. It's crazy. It's like, and in 3 years, right? You guys have been in real estate for 3 years. So like in 3 years, just looking at where you started and where you are now, it seems you two just kept pushing. You kept pushing, you kept learning, you kept refining the process, but you didn't give up. And I feel like a lot of people in the face of those kind of challenges might give up. They might say, maybe real estate is not for me, but I think it just goes to show. Yeah. But thankfully you had someone.
Keep pushing.
You gotta have, I think that's the beauty of also having a partner, whether it's your spouse or someone else. Sometimes you're gonna have one person that's like, man, I don't know if I wanna keep doing this. This is a lot. It can be stressful. And then you have the other person there, like, you know, man up. You know, we'll get through this, it'll be okay. This is just a learning lesson. We always say no losses, only lessons.
Definitely.
Yeah, what you're saying was really good though. We agree.
definitely. But I think it's just testament to just continuing to push forth, continuing to not give up, put yourself out there, because now, you know, we're in an age where you can meet your next investor on Instagram in a DM, you know, or on Facebook or whatever. So I think that's something else for people to keep in mind. And where can people find you if they want to work with you, if they want to invest with you, or access any of the resources you have available?
Go to petwayestates.com, PETTWAY estates.com. You'll pretty much find anything, whether you're looking for a house to buy, whether you're trying to find a home to rent, whether you're looking for a project yourself, if you're an out-of-state investor and you want to get on our list. If you are a retail client, you don't want to invest, but you want, you know, someone to do your house remodel, or if you want to invest with us, or if you're an investor, you want to learn, you can go to petwaytoolbox.com. And like my husband mentioned, we have a free course. You know, people always tell us it shouldn't be free because we give out so much game in there. It's crazy. We basically get you from A to Z from investing on your first property. So check those two websites out, petwaytoolbox.com to learn how to invest, or if you want to actually partner with us, petwayestates.com.
Absolutely, we definitely have all those in the show notes. Is he raising his hand?
Yeah. I have something to say.
What do you have to say, DJ? But definitely appreciate you two coming on. This is very inspiring. I'm sure our listeners will learn a whole lot about real estate investing, about flipping, about working as a team, and just growing. So really appreciate you two taking the time to join.
No doubt, man. No doubt. Our privilege to just being on your podcast, man. Thank you for the opportunity.
We appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. You can find us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue, or on Twitter at Bread Podcast, at BRED Podcast. Look forward to talking to you all soon.